It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, April 1st, 2023. I'm Chad Pergram. A Manhattan grand jury this week indicted former President Trump, leaving much at stake for his 2024 presidential campaign.
I mean, this could not only go to through Election Day 2024. If Trump wins, there could be court cases going through Inauguration Day 2025.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Next year's military budget is pretty large. Defense officials say it's needed to meet the challenges posed by China. But some lawmakers had some pointed questions in recent hearings, less about the amount and more about how it's all being spent.
As the nuclear threats grow, Republican lawmakers are correct to say this is moving too slowly. We can't be stuck with this outdated force as Russia and China are building new and more things.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. A Manhattan grand jury indicted former President Trump Thursday. That leaves much at stake for his legal and political future. Joining me to discuss the politics of the indictment and the reactions from Capitol Hill, my colleague, Fox News DC-based correspondent David Spunt. David, you know, this indictment of the former president really rocked Washington and rocked New York. Let me start from your angle. You cover the Department of Justice and talk about just how unprecedented this is and what the impacts of this, you know, could be as we go forward, especially as we get closer to 2024.
Well, Chad, it's unprecedented. And the folks in the Department of Justice, while they won't comment on this investigation, you better believe they're watching it closely. And the reason is because there are two investigations being run out of the Department of Justice. I mean, technically, they're being run by Special Counsel Jack Smith. Merrick Garland appointed him back in November of last year to look into two separate issues involving the former president, the potential chance to overturn the 2020 election January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, everything basically from Election Day to Inauguration Day when Trump was no longer president. Also, Jack Smith, the special counsel, is looking at the Mar-a-Lago documents, and 10,000 documents plus were taken from Mar-a-Lago by FBI agents early last August, August 8th. About 100 of them had documents marked classified with classified markings. So there are some very serious investigations going on a federal level at the Department of Justice. So those folks watching it quickly. And as you mentioned, leading up to 2024, I mean, this could not only go to through Election Day 2024. If Trump wins, there could be court cases going through Inauguration Day 2025.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fascinating. And, you know, you stumbled upon a little very interesting historical nugget involving arrests of presidents and former presidents here. Tell us about that.
So, you know, we were looking at the history of presidential arrests, not a topic that you think that there would be a lot on. And we found that while former President Donald Trump is the first president to be indicted by a grand jury, if he is indeed arrested with handcuffs next week, which we don't believe that's going to be the case, we believe he's going to self-surrender, he would not be the first president to be arrested if he was arrested. Granted, he is a former president, but Ulysses Grant was arrested in 1871. And this is according to an article in the Washington Star, a newspaper at the time. He was arrested for speeding on his horse, no kidding, on M Street in Washington, D.C. while he was president, taken to the local police station by an African-American man who actually was born with slave ties and became a policeman.
And that was the police officer.
That was the police officer,
right?
In 1871. Yeah. And it really an incredible story. And he went ahead and gave his account in a newspaper. His name is William West. You know, it's fascinating to think about. I mean, this was 1871. He gave a newspaper interview on September 27th, 1908, recounting the fact that he went up to President Grant and said, "You're speeding on your horse." And President Grant apologized. They took him to the local station, and he did face a charge at the time.
And Kathy Lanier, who used to be the police chief in Washington, D.C., talked about this a few years ago, you know, and kind of confirmed this. I mean, this is one of these little nuggets of obscure history. But to be clear here, you know, President Trump, former President Trump, he's the first president to be indicted. And that's why this is so seismic.
Exactly. Indicted by a grand jury as we know it today. You know, Ulysses S. Grant, things get lost in history and lost in time. So we don't know exactly what happened when Grant went to the local station. But I can promise you he was not indicted by a grand jury as we know a grand jury today. So Donald Trump makes history there, no question.
And tell us about the concerns when he does appear before this grand jury. When he is arraigned, I should say, you know, what this is going to be like in New York City. You know, for several weeks now, we have heard concerns about protests and security. The DA's office in New York City, in Manhattan, they've expressed concerns about the security of their prosecutors and also Alvin Bragg, the head DA there. There's been some concern here in Washington, D.C., but much to a much less degree here in Washington. But they did put up some fences around the Capitol, not the big ones that they had after January 6th. But they did have what was told, what I was told here, was kind of an enhanced security force. They have more officers ready to go and put up this kind of light perimeter around the Capitol. You can still, you know, go back and forth. But what's it like in New York? What's the overall concern as they get closer to his arraignment and as people actually learn what the charges are?
Well, we learned that law enforcement is meeting in New York, which is really no surprise. That's pretty much par for the course. The Secret Service will be accompanying the former president from Florida to Manhattan to self-surrender next week. We believe it's going to be on Tuesday. The Secret Service is, in this case, protecting a former president, so the footprint is not nearly as big as if he was still an occupant of the White House and the commander-in-chief. So the Secret Service's role is fairly limited just to keep him safe. They're going to have him go in. He's going to be fingerprinted. He's going to be booked, which means he's going to have a mugshot taken. In New York, mugshots typically are not released to the public. In New York, you typically don't see a grand jury that's not seating on a day release an indictment of a former president. So the rules here, my point, Chad, is that the rules are a little bit pliable here because we truly are in uncharted territory. I hate to use a trite phrase like that. But as of now, law enforcement, the FBI, the NYPD, Secret Service, everybody coming together to have a safety plan. We know that New York police are told to be in full uniform throughout this weekend and through this whole process, just in case things get out of control. There is a sense of relief from law enforcement that nothing happened of any note after this was announced. Of course, everybody is on edge, and you've reported this before, following January 6th, whether it's in Washington, D.C. or New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, wherever it may be. So there is a strong law enforcement presence that will be ready. But as far as how this goes down in New York, we believe that whatever day it is, whether it's Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, whenever it may be, this will be about a 15 or 20 minute thing inside the courthouse, and Donald Trump will leave. They'll set a schedule. He'll come back after that, and things will move on through the justice system. But it's those other cases down the pike that really may stretch this out into 2024, because this thing could be stretched out. I mean, 2024 election, Chad, is only, as you know, a year and a half away. That's not a long time. And you know how long court cases go. So if he's just indicted in this one now, this will probably go at least to mid-2024. But if he's indicted in these other cases, the two cases being investigated by special counsel Jack Smith and the one being investigated by the local DA in Georgia for that phone call with the Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, where you could hear the president at the time say, I need you to find 11,780 votes. If there are indictments in that, the further down the pike those indictments come, the further after the election and potentially after the inauguration, you know, we could see court activity.
And that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, as a lot of legal scholars will say to us up here, you know, the Constitution is not self-executing. People have asked questions about whether or not if he is indicted, if he is prosecuted, if he is convicted, what does that say about him being able to serve? You might remember in the second impeachment trial, there was a lot of debate about whether or not they could actually, you know, bar him from, you know, serving another term as president. You know, had he been convicted in the Senate in the trial after the riot, they thought that they probably, you know, could have barred him. But again, it's not self-executing. How do you tell states to keep, you know, this candidate off the books. You have a constitutional conflict there when you look at the qualifications for somebody to be president, you know, 35 years of age and, you know, citizen of the United States and so on.
Born
and so
in this
forth.
Country. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And that's always been kind of vague, too. I remember this was the issue with Ted Cruz, you know, who was
sure.
born in Calgary, Alberta, you know, and wasn't actually born in the United States. You had somebody like Barry Goldwater, who was the senator from Arizona and the nominee in 1964, and Arizona was a territory at that point. John McCain was born in the Canal Zone in Panama. Mm-hmm. You know, not a, so,
exactly.
so again, there's a bit of so again, but the rest of those constitutional requirements seem to be pretty immutable, and that's why people are saying, well, we just can't. You know, keep him out. It would probably be up to, frankly, the House, you know, if you have a dispute in the Electoral College to certify whether or not this person or somebody else is qualified to be president. I mean, that's, again, we're back to some of that stuff related to January 6th. You know, one of the things that I've been covering in this, David, is the investigation that three House committees, House Administration Committee, the House Oversight Committee, and the Judiciary Committee have mm-hmm. launched into Alvin Bragg, because what they want to know here is, what federal funds are being spent in this? Is there any liaison between the Department of Justice and his office about doing this? And also, do they have jurisdiction? That's where the House Administration Committee gets involved, because they have jurisdiction over federal elections. And so, you know, one of the arguments is this is a former president. This is a local DA in New York City in one borough. You can't prosecute the president. And, you know, there's been these volleys back and forth between the House committees, this triumvirate of committees, and then Bragg's office. And Bragg's office has responded again. There was a deadline for Friday.
Yes.
And they said, first of all, the reason we're not cooperating with your investigation, they said, we're happy to come talk to you, but we're not going to provide too much information here. As they said, secrecy is critical to the target of any investigation. They termed this in a letter that was sent to the general counsel for the DA's office to the House committee chair.
This was the one today, correct?
Yes, exactly. They viewed this as interference. They called this unprecedented. And they said that this was what they termed an illegitimate incursion. Now, historically, House committees and Senate committees, they have stayed out of prosecutions. And that's what's so extraordinary here, is that you have them infusing themselves into this debate. And how much information they get from Alvin Bragg, who knows? But again, as you say, you know, a prosecution is going to take some time. If something happens with Jack Smith's inquiry, are they going to call those, you know, prosecutors as well, you know, the special counsel or whatnot? You start to get into a very interesting landscape there, David.
Very much. And it's a very slippery slope. And, you know, there have been many allegations, and you know this, covering this over the past few weeks, on the Republican side, hurling at Attorney General Merrick Garland, arguing that he is controlling the narrative in the Alvin Bragg probe. And DOJ officials have told me that they're annoyed by hearing that, because it's not, they push back strongly and say, listen, that's a local state investigation that has nothing to do with what we do here at the Justice Department. The former president, even in one of his posts on his own social media platform, when it came out that, you know, the grand jury was getting close, this was a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump posted something along the lines of, you know, Alvin Bragg may be pushing forward with this investigation, but this is really being run by the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. That's who's pulling the strings here. So, you know, DOJ officials completely deny this. They vehemently say this is not true. And, you know, that's where we are on that.
Yeah. And imagine, you know, with an investigation like this, you know, with the Mar-a-Lago investigation about the documents. You know, the flip side of this is you've had the intelligence committees on both sides, and even Democrats, being very displeased with information that the intelligence community has provided them. You know, they have oversight over the investigation there, at least the intelligence services, and been saying, wait a minute, you know, we deserve to understand what documents might have been taken, which ones may have been classified. And they've been kind of semi-stonewalled by the DOJ as well. You know,
and that's in a bipartisan way, too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this has been the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, this has been pretty partisan. You've had most Democrats say, look, you know, this is wrong. You shouldn't be involved. Republicans going to the mat. And this is what's interesting, the politics of this. On the Republican side, after the midterms, there was a window of time where some Republicans were like, hey, he has not helped us in three consecutive cycles here now, meaning former President Trump, 2018, mm-hmm. 2020, 2022. We didn't get the Senate back. He lost us the seats in Georgia in 2020. We barely won the House when people thought we were going to win 50 seats. There were some bad candidates who he supported, Herschel Walker and others in Georgia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can't, you know, do it with this guy. But their base, the hard right Republican base tends to still be there with former President Trump. And that's, you know, 30-35% of the electorate and a bigger portion of the Republican Party. So there has not been this break. And you've had Republicans, you know, say quietly, you know, we need to get off this train. But they realize for the moment, this is good politics to at least stand behind the former president. But here's a case study in what's happened as to what the problem is for Republicans.
Yes.
Their bill in the House of Representatives, the number one bill, H.R. 1, in other words, you know, you assign the first, you know, bills in order of importance to you as the party, if you're in the majority. So H.R. 1 was this energy bill to lower the price of gas, accelerate drilling permits. And they had a big celebration here at the Capitol when they passed the bill. It was a bipartisan passage here. Four Democrats voted yes for this. Only one Republican defection. The bill probably won't go anywhere in the Senate, but there's some moderate Democrats who might like it. And within 4 hours, everybody was again talking about former President Trump and not energy. And this is the problem for Republicans, is that he continue, you know, he's almost like a black hole here. His gravitational pull politically is so big that nothing can survive outside. It sucks all these other political star systems inside. And this is the problem for Republicans as they try to figure out the course going into 2024.
And you see them in the hallway, and I see them in the hallway and mostly on tape because I'm at the Justice Department, and they're talking about something, and they get asked about President Trump, and they have to switch gears totally, and then they end up speaking about that, and guess which soundbite makes it on the air, not only our network, but on every network, and that's how the Trump cycle lives, as you say.
Absolutely. Well, David, good to talk with you, and again, great work covering this, and good luck in the next year and a half, perhaps.
Thank you so much, Chad.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Over the last couple of weeks, top military brass has appeared before Congress to present the Biden administration's next military budget, and it's a big one, $842 billion, a 3.2% increase over last year, and a 13.4% increase over fiscal year 2022.
This is a strategy-driven budget, and one driven by the seriousness of our strategic competition with the People's Republic of China.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin testified this past week before the Senate Armed Services Committee and earlier testified before the House Appropriations Committee alongside Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley. Secretary Austin told lawmakers this is a budget that meets the moment with a 40% increase for the Pacific Deterrence Initiative at a total of $9.1 billion.
Now, this budget also makes the department's largest ever investments in both R&D, and procurement.
He mentioned requests for aircraft fighters, sea power, and three new submarine purchases. But some Republicans had concerns, not necessarily about the price tag, as much as where it's all being spent. House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee Chairman, Republican Congressman Ken Calvert, was concerned about the decommissioning of some ships.
Mr. Secretary, how does having fewer ships deter Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific?
Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker expressed concerns over how slowly some things are moving, in his opinion.
Our current nuclear modernization efforts are moving too slowly and will produce a force ill-equipped to deter multiple nuclear-armed adversaries.
Wicker asked both Austin and Milley at one point.
Secretary Austin, first, would you agree that this is the most complex and dangerous threat environment since World War II?
Yes, Senator. I would say that it's one of the most complex periods that we've seen.
General Milley.
Yes, Senator, for sure.
Okay.
While China dominated the hearings, our expenditures and commitments in Ukraine, as well as Iran and the Middle East broadly, remained factors as well.
It is a large increase, and there are a lot of good things in this budget request.
Patty Jane Geller is the senior policy analyst for nuclear deterrence and missile defense at the Heritage Foundation's Center for National Defense.
But the truth of the matter is that it barely is able to pace inflation. And when there's a budget that's not really pacing inflation, it adds up to a cut in real terms and what the military can actually buy for for its service members. So, you know, I heard in the news that this is being touted as the largest defense budget ever. And that may be true, but it's actually not doing enough in giving us the ability to buy what we need to prepare the military for the threats that we're facing, which I think are probably the most significant in our history.
In two of the recent hearings, Republican members of the House and Senate questioned this notion that we're actually decommissioning some Navy ships. I know we're building, it sounds like we're building 9 new ones, but decommissioning 11. And the House Appropriations Committee chairman asked, you know, point blank, how does having fewer ships prepare us for the threat we face with China? And then General Milley stressed, you know, we don't go to war alone. We would be supported by allies as well. Should we, though, have more ships? I know the goal is to have more.
Yes, we need more ships. You know, I certainly appreciate the sentiment and the idea that we have allies that we can work with, but our allies aren't supposed to make up for the lack in U.S. capability. You know, the U.S. is the leader. You know, we're the supposed to have the number one military in the world, and we don't want to be completely dependent on our allies if we get into a conflict with China, whose ship capacity is growing at a much higher rate than ours is. You know, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I believe we are ultimately going to decommission more ships than we're going to gain over the next several years. And this is concerning to me because if we get involved in a conflict with China, you know, that's going to be primarily a sea-based fight out in the Indo-Pacific. And, you know, we might have great capabilities, better ships than China, but at the end of the day, if we're engaged in a war of attrition, we need as much capacity as we can to face the threat that is growing. I'll just add one more thing. You know, U.S. ability to build ships, it's very slow. Our shipbuilding capacity has weakened over the last several years, but China has an active shipbuilding capacity. And I think that's concerning. You know, this is not the time to be looking to decommission more ships than we're building. We need capacity for this fight.
We heard Secretary Austin also reference COVID when he was pressed on sort of getting some arms, getting materials to other countries, to allies. I think Taiwan was mentioned in particular, that COVID and the supply chain backlog and that really impacted us. Do you have any insight into how COVID slowed us down?
I'm not a full expert on how COVID impacted supply chains. I know that certainly was a problem, and there are backlogs. I know that there's significant backlog on shipping equipment to Taiwan. You know, but that I'm not exactly sure that the best way to solve that problem. But I know that, you know, to make up for the impacts of COVID, we can't just slow roll and, you know, cut the defense budget. I think this is a reason we need to keep moving forward and provide the resources that are needed to make up for the COVID supply chain mm-hmm. issues and progress the U.S. military and that of our allies as the threats grow.
China has a new foreign minister, and Secretary Austin referenced him. He said in March he echoed China's President Xi Jinping that conflict with the U.S. is inevitable unless the U.S. stops suppressing them. General Milley said war with China is not inevitable, but that a very strong military is that deterrence. And then he went on to remark, you know, about the enormous growth of wealth in China. Their military has advanced, he said, to a world-class military near peer, were his words, to the United States. Secretary Austin said the goal is to make it so unappealing for China to do anything by having such a military presence, by growing our own force and materials. And I suppose you can go on a bit and answer, but in your mind, when you look at the broad landscape, what do we need? I mean, we're talking about ships, but more broadly, maybe.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just go back to the first thing you said, because it really struck me that line by, I think, China's foreign minister about how the U.S. is trying to suppress China with our buildup. I just want to say that's a perfect example of Chinese propaganda. You know, China has been, you know, hiding its capabilities and biding its time for the last 25 years, you know, while the U.S. was off fighting terrorism. We are not in no way provoking China's massive military buildup. They have their own goals to supplant the U.S. on the world stage, and the U.S. is not driving it. So back to your question, yes, General Milley is exactly right when he says that we need to have the military needed to convince China that invading Taiwan, provoking the U.S. in any way would not be in its interest, because it would lose. So to your question of, you know, what exactly do we need? I'll tell you, I guess, a few things that we need to focus on. I think we need to be able to reorient our forces towards the Indo-Pacific. And this is hard because I don't think this means, you know, pulling out of other areas of the world like Europe and the Middle East, because those regions of conflict still matter. But we need to be procuring more ships, like as we discussed, since the Indo-Pacific conflict would be primarily sea-based. Right. In general, we need a bigger capacity, ships, aircraft. You know, this is going to be a high-end fight with China, and we need to be able to, in my opinion, not just deter an initial attack, but if deterrence fails, be able to fight and win in a long fight of attrition. And then, as the nuclear deterrence analyst at Heritage, I have to throw in the importance of having a strong nuclear deterrent as we craft a force that is able to deter China. When you think about how, you know, nuclear weapons, they're used as a last resort. They probably, you know, wouldn't be used first in any sort of conflict with China, but
hopefully
hopefully. And that's exactly why we need to have a strong nuclear deterrent, because nuclear weapons serve as a backstop to the rest of our military force. So my concern is that if as China continues its massive nuclear expansion and, you know, the U.S. doesn't build up its forces in return, China might become more confident to either start a fight in the Indo-Pacific or escalate that one, because they know that they'll have that backing of a nuclear force to, you know, intimidate and coerce the U.S. So getting our nuclear forces right, I think, is just as important as having the things we need early in a conflict, like ships or aircraft.
Yeah, talk to me more about that, because one of the things that some of the Republican lawmakers were noting that they think we're moving too slowly on is our nuclear triad, specifically modernization efforts. Forgive my ignorance in this question, but does that mean our nukes are too old? Like, what does that mean, modernizing? Is it the missile delivery system? Is it all of it?
It's all of it is too old. So all components of our nuclear force, the missile systems, the warheads, and the infrastructure on which we rely to maintain those systems are from the Cold War era. And I'll give you just a few examples. Our long-range missiles, our ICBMs that are deployed out in the Midwest of the U.S., were built in the 1960s, deployed in 1970. They were supposed to retire in 1980, but we've been squeezing the life out of them since then. You know, these things were developed before we even had computers. Then our nuclear warheads, we're still using the same nuclear material, the plutonium, from the Cold War, from the Manhattan Project era when we first developed these warheads. Wow. And we're not really sure of the impacts of, you know, decades of aging has on the warheads. You know, will they still work? And then some of the buildings where our scientists and engineers maintain our nuclear weapons are also old from the Manhattan era project. There are ceilings falling down in some of these buildings. So yes, everything we've got is really old, and we are working to modernize everything across the board, from, you know, doing those construction projects to rebuild things and to procuring modern missile systems that were just built in this century and not in the 1960s. But yes, as the nuclear threats grow, Republican lawmakers are correct to say this is moving too slowly. We can't be stuck with this outdated force as Russia and China are building new and more things.
Briefly on the nuclear front, this past week, Russia said they were going to move some of their arsenal to Belarus, and the president of Belarus has said, yes, some of them may be stockpiled there. Moving nukes sounds serious. Is it, and how serious?
Yeah, so first I would say, I think this is just the latest incident of Vladimir Putin's nuclear saber rattling and total lack of responsibility when it comes to how he handles his nuclear weapons. You know, so far we haven't seen Putin take any action to move them to Belarus. I'm not sure if he will. It's possible that this is another attempt to coerce and intimidate the West with nuclear threats. But if he does make that move, if Belarus accepts nuclear weapons, I do think this would be significant, partly because it would, you know, bring nuclear weapons even closer to some NATO states like Poland and Lithuania. And partly because of, I think, the psychological deterrent and impact it would have on our allies. You know, they might demand more U.S. assurances, and it would give Russia the ability to, like, greater ability to coerce and intimidate when he can say, well, we've got nuclear weapons right on NATO's border.
couple more for you on munitions. We know the Center for Strategic and International Studies put out a report earlier this year that we are dangerously short, in part due to our helping of Ukraine. But my understanding is this budget has more than $30 billion to sort of start replenishing us on that front. And specifically, Secretary Austin said the procurement, right, of munitions, he actually thanked lawmakers for giving them this thing called multi-year procurement capability, and that specifically is helping us maybe or will help us replenish munitions. Can you address that shift in how the military gets to operate with multi-year procurement ability?
Absolutely. I don't know if I can go into the details of how that multi-year procurement works, but I will say that we are facing this, you know, the war in Ukraine has woken us up to the issue we're facing with munitions. You know, we're remembering that war isn't about, you know, just trying to get through the first handful of days or trying to deter an attack. If we actually get involved in a conflict, you know, we need to be able to sustain our ability to fight. And it's not just the types of munitions, it's how many you have. So I think it is a good move that Congress has given this authority to the DoD to replenish munitions, because you know, Ukraine is waking us up to the fact that if there is a conflict between the U.S. and China, we need our defense industrial base working, and we need to be able to continue procurement buys year after year for munitions in order to sustain a conflict. And you know, some people have said that we're wasting a lot of our munitions on Ukraine, but I'm honestly really glad that Ukraine is waking us up to this issue now so we can get started on these procurements and prepare the U.S. for a future conflict.
And speaking of Ukraine, you know, for all the talk we hear among some House Republicans that we need to maybe reexamine how much aid we give Ukraine, it sounds like there were quite a few Republicans at these military budget hearings. Ken Calvert, Roger Wicker, Senator, they were questioning if we are just giving them enough and wondering if we do need to do more. And General Milley, it sounded like, was making quite a case for us continuing to help Ukraine. And both Secretary Austin and General Milley said, we will continue to help Ukraine as long as it takes.
Yeah, I agree with Senator Wicker. I do think we need to do more to help Ukraine. And I often see it's kind of portrayed where, you know, Biden wants to do more and some Republicans think we're doing too much. But really what I've seen is that the Biden administration has been too slow over the last year and a month to give Ukraine the weapons it needs. I think if you ask me, if we had given Ukraine more advanced capabilities like the Patriot missiles, you know, 8 months ago instead of just recently, they would be in a better place than they are today. And maybe we wouldn't have to sustain them for quite so long. So I do think it would be in the interest of the U.S. to give Ukraine more an advanced weaponry so Ukraine can actually not just keep a stalemate going with Russia, but win this conflict. Because ultimately, a Russian-controlled Ukraine up on the border of our NATO allies would not be in the interest of the U.S. So I agree we need to give Ukraine the weapons it needs to try and end this conflict as quickly as possible.
Finally, there was a report card issued grading the Pentagon. I believe it came out of the Reagan Institute's National Security Innovation Base Summit that they're now holding. We didn't do so well on the report card. We got a D on customer clarity, specifically signaling to the industrial base on, I guess, our tech needs, that we're sending a blurry signal on what we're willing to pay for. And we got a D-plus on talent base. And I'm reading here, the defense workforce is aging and does not recruit diverse talent proficient in emerging technologies. I know there's a lot in this new budget for R&D, a big boost in research and development. Is that enough to maybe rectify some of these pretty poor grades we got in some of these areas?
That's interesting. I'll have to take a look at that report card. You know, I hear the Heritage Foundation, we say that the defense industrial base has atrophied. It's become anemic over, you know, the last several decades. You know, since the Cold War, the U.S. hasn't had to really prepare for a big, great power fight where we've needed to kind of kickstart our defense industry. So it certainly makes sense to me to hear that we don't have all of the talent that we necessarily need to spur the defense industrial base. You know, I certainly appreciate that this budget has a significant fund for research and development. And I hope that this will go towards kind of rebooting our defense industrial base. But, you know, it's the focus can't only be on R&D. The fight is not necessarily in 10 years. It's possible that it could be here today, tomorrow, or in just a couple of years. So I'm a little more focused on making sure we're procuring the capabilities we need over the next handful of years, while getting that defense industrial base back in shape in order to be able to help us sustain a conflict in the long term.
We touched on a lot. I don't know if you have anything else you think is important to mention. I know recruitment, for example, was talked about, and they referenced COVID was really sort of a problem there in getting their recruiters into high schools. I know there are many other topics that were touched on in these hearings, but does anything else come to mind for you as we move ahead into 2024?
Yeah, I'd love to touch on recruitment briefly, actually. The Heritage Foundation released a report of the Independent Panel on Military Service and Readiness that looked at recruiting and why we're having so much trouble with it. You know, this is, I think, the worst year for the U.S. military and recruiting. And we're seeing issues where politics are seeping into the military. People are less willing to join for, you know, the way that the military is perceived. And I just want to throw in the importance of recruiting and being able to have a ready military, because I care a lot about nuclear deterrence, as I discussed. And if we don't have enough men who are, you know, not only there in the military ready to go, but also prepared for the fight and not distracted by political priorities, then they won't be ready to be able to defend the nation and, you know, operate our nuclear weapons, if, you know, hopefully we never need to do that. But this is almost a prerequisite, solving that recruitment problem before we can even get to the other issues. So I think that's something that Congress is going to be taking a close look at this year as well.
Patty Jane Geller with the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, we talk about infrastructure, recent spills and accidents, and the implementation of the infrastructure law, as well as Kentucky politics and what this year's governor's race could mean for 2024. Until then, I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.